Hello and welcome to the talking show.
Hey,
on K-Chung Radio,
Chinatown,
Los Angeles's most important arts-focused micro-broadcasting radio initiative,
using only amplitude modulation.
My name is Steve Cato, and as ever, I am here with...
Who are you with, Steve?
That's right, with Nicholas Miller.
Oh, yeah.
But today we are not in our K-Chung facility. We are we're doing something special this week. What we're doing this week is we are actually in my hometown. We're doing this by remote from Toronto, Ontario, Canada.
Our first remote episode ever.
That's right. That's right. A place hopelessly remote from our normal Los Angeles digs.
Yeah. You know, Canada looks just like Texas.
It's funny you say that, Nicholas. You know, that's something people say all the time about Toronto when they're first introduced to it, when they're new to it. But anyway, there's so much I could obviously say about Toronto. It's been on and off my home for such a long time. And you know, you grow up someplace, you definitely just come to know an awful lot about it.
I know what you mean, Steve.
But there's a reason why we're in Toronto. You don't just go to Toronto. You have to go to Toronto for a reason.
Clearly.
And, sorry, it's also a little chilly here. The reason why we're here is because Nicholas and I have been facilitating a residency on Toronto Island.
Yeah. People have come from far and wide to hear us.
Yes, that's right. We've been leading a residency. I think you can guess what the focus of the residency is. It is, of course,
post-studio sculpture.
Talking.
Oh, yeah.
And today we have something really special. Our residents are going to produce today's talking show.
Yeah, we're taking a big risk here in allowing some perhaps unseasoned talkers attempt an episode of the incredibly rigorous talking show.
That's right, Nicholas. You know, it has been a real pleasure working with the residents.
Yeah. I think I may have learned more than they have.
So, we'll just let them go for it, and we'll get in touch after.
As always.
Here they are, billed as us.
Steve, are you sure it's not U.S.? I mean, I see the U and the S. But did they say us? I think we'll have to loop back around afterwards on that one.
Amelia Honing and Jason Hirata, live from Toronto, Ontario, on Los Angeles's only K-Chung Radio.
Forward by Tom Palmer, webmaster.
Dear friends, the following information is in response to the handful of questions I regularly receive by email from fans such as yourself. What follows are conclusions I have drawn by piecing together communications I've had with the man himself, various representatives, and numerous fans. The stories I have provided are based on a number of assumptions that may or may not be true, so be forewarned that my narrative is far from being definitive or accurate. That said, I hope you find my best educated guesses to be helpful.
Introduction by Craig Owens.
In a review of Carl Sagan's collected works published in this journal in fall 1979, I proposed that Sagan's genius was an allegorical one, involved in the liquidation of a worldview which he perceived as more or less ruined. To impute an allegorical motive to contemporary thought is to venture into prescribed territory, for allegory has been condemned for nearly two centuries as aesthetic aberration, the antithesis of art. In Aesthetic, Croce refers to it as science or art aping science. Borges once called it an aesthetic error. Quote, every operation to which Sagan subjects these pictures represents the duration of a fascinated, perplexed gaze whose desire is that they disclose their secrets. But the result is only to make the pictures all the more picture-like, to fix forever in an elegant object our distance from the history that produces these images. That distance is all these pictures signify. Sagan's is thus the melancholy gaze which Benjamin identified with the allegorical temperament. Quote, if the object becomes allegorical under the gaze of melancholy, if melancholy causes life to flow out of it, and it remains behind dead, but eternally secure, then it is exposed to the allegorist, it is unconditionally in his power. That is to say, it is now quite incapable of emanating any meaning or significance of its own. Such significance as it has, it acquires from the allegorist. He places it within it and stands behind it, not in a psychological, but in an ontological sense. Sagan's images simultaneously proffer and defer a promise of meaning. They both solicit and frustrate our desire that the image be directly transparent to its signification. As a result, they appear strangely incomplete, fragments or runes which must be deciphered. Allegory is consistently attracted to the fragmentary, the imperfect, the incomplete, an affinity which finds its most comprehensive expression in the ruin, which Benjamin identified as the allegorical emblem par excellence. Here, the works of man are reabsorbed into the landscape. Ruins thus stand for history as an irreversible process of dissolution and decay, a progressive distancing from origin. Quote, in allegory, the observer is confronted with the facies Hippocratica of history as a petrified primordial landscape. Everything about history that, from the very beginning, had been untimely, sorrowful, unsuccessful, is expressed in a face, or rather, in a death's head. And although such a thing lacks all symbolic freedom of expression, all classical proportion, all humanity, nevertheless, this is the form in which man's subjection to nature is most obvious, and it significantly gives rise to not only the enigmatic question of the nature of human existence as such, but also the biographical historicity of the individual. This is the heart of the allegorical way of seeing.
Who Speaks? By Carl Sagan.
The person now in jeopardy is Arnold. As the ancient mythmakers knew, he is a child equally of the earth and sky. In his tenure of this planet, he has accumulated dangerous evolutionary baggage, propensities for aggression and ritual, submission to leaders, hostility to outsiders, all of which puts his survival in some doubt. But he has also acquired compassion for others, love for his children, a desire to learn from history and experience, and a great, soaring, passionate intelligence, the clear tools for his continued survival and prosperity. Which aspects of Arnold's nature will prevail is uncertain, particularly when his visions and prospects are bound to one small part of the small planet Earth. But up and in the cosmos, an inescapable perspective awaits. Personal boundaries are not evidenced when we view Arnold from space. Fanatic ethnic or religious or national identifications are a little difficult to support when we see Arnold as a fragile human, fading to become an inconspicuous point of light against the bastion and citadel of human history. There are not yet obvious signs of intelligence commensurate with Arnold, and this makes us wonder whether people like him rush inevitably into self-destruction. I dream about it, and sometimes they are bad dreams. In the vision of the dream, I once imagined myself searching for other intelligent life in humanity. Among billions and billions of human beings, life and intelligence should have arisen in many people. Some people are barren and desolate. In them, life never began or may have been extinguished in some cosmic catastrophe. There may be people rich in life, not yet evolved to intelligence and luminance. There may be people who achieved luminance and then promptly used it to destroy themselves. And perhaps there are also people who learn to live with their luminance and themselves, beings who endure and become citizens of the cosmos. Immersed in these thoughts, I felt a longing. Arnold. The television transmissions rushed past me. I found myself approaching a person who was clearly inhabited, a person I had visited before. I saw a person encompassed by light and recognized the signature of intelligence. But suddenly, darkness, total and absolute. In my dream, I could read the Book of Inhabitants, a vast encyclopedia of the billions of people on this planet. What could this text tell me about this now darkened person? He must have survived some earlier catastrophe. His biology was different from mine. I wondered what that light had been for. There must have been signs Arnold was in trouble. Communications interrupted. His personality must have failed. He must have made the ultimate mistake. But the dream was not yet done. Had he destroyed himself? What had he done to his body? There had been many ways for him to perish at his own hands. He had poisoned the mind and spirit. He had ravaged his flesh. Perhaps his position had changed. Could it have been greed or ego? I remembered the text. What would it say about Arnold? There was his generation. There was the man. I had found the entry for Arnold. They had heard his television broadcasts and thought them an application for cosmic citizenship. His luminance had been growing enormously. They got that right. Entertainment, business, philanthropy, politics. Probability of survival over a decade, less than 1%. So it was burnout. A full, personal holocaust. There would be no more big questions, no more answers. Never again a thought or a feeling. No more Herculean feats of strength. No more songs from the earth. All that shit's gone now. I saw Austria and thought, several decades ago, Arnold took his first steps there. His brain grew and changed. The old parts began to be guided by the new parts, and this made him human, with compassion and foresight and reason. But instead, he listened to that reptilian voice within us, counseling fear, territoriality, and aggression. He accepted the products of science. He rejected its methods. Maybe the reptiles will evolve intelligence once more. Perhaps one day there will be intelligent life again on Earth. There will be life. There will be intelligence. But there will be no Arnold. Not here. Not in a billion worlds.
Total Recall, Part 1.
I was born into a year of famine. It was 1947 and Austria was occupied by the Allied armies that had defeated Hitler's Third Reich. In May, 2 months before I was born, there were hunger riots in Vienna and in Styria, the southeastern province where we lived. The food shortages were just as bad. Tar was the name of our very typical farm village. A few hundred families made up the entire population. The houses and farms clustered in hamlets, connected by footpaths and lanes. The unpaved main road ran for a couple of kilometers up and down the low alpine hills, covered with fields and pine forests. It was absolutely gorgeous. Our house was on top of a hill along the road, and as I was growing up, it was unusual to see more than one or two cars coming by our house a day. A ruined castle dating back to the feudal times was right across from us, 100 yards from our door. And on the next rise was the mayor's office and the Catholic church where my mother made us all go to Sunday Mass every week. And then there was a local Gasthaus or inn, which was the social heart of the village, and the primary school, which was attended by me and my brother Meinhard, who was 1 year older than me. My boyhood home was a very simple stone and brick building, well proportioned, with thick walls and little windows to keep out the Alpine winters. We had two bedrooms. Each was equipped with coal ovens for heat, and, of course, the kitchen, where we ate and where we did our homework and washed ourselves and played games, where we literally did everything. That kitchen was heated by my mother's stove. There was no plumbing, no shower, no flushing toilet, just a kind of chamber pot. The nearest well was almost a quarter mile away, and even when it was raining hard or snowing, one of us had to go and get that water. So we would use as little water as we could. We would heat it, and we would fill the wash basin and give ourselves sponge or cloth bath. I remember my mother always would wash herself first with the clean water, nice and warm water. Next, my father would wash himself, and then Meinert and I would have our turn. And it didn't matter if we had, of course, slightly darker water by now, as long as we could avoid a trip to the well and schlep up that water. Now, we had wooden furniture, very basic, and a few electric lamps. My father liked, of course, pictures and antiques, but when we were growing up, these were luxuries that he could not afford. Now, music and cats brought liveliness to our house. We had 7 cats at one time. And my mother played the zither, and she sang songs and lullabies. But it was my father who was the real musician in the house. He would play all of the wind and reed instruments, like the trumpets, saxophones, clarinets, and the list would go on and on and on. He also wrote music, and he was the conductor of the region's gendarmerie band. If a police officer, for instance, would die anywhere in our state, the band would then play at that funeral, and my father would be conducting the music. And often on Sundays in the summer, we would go to the concert in the park, where he would conduct the band and sometimes actually play himself. Most of our relatives on his side were very musical, but that talent, sadly to say, never made it to Meinhard or me. Now, I'm not sure why we had cats instead of dogs. Maybe because my mother loved them, and they cost nothing because they caught their own food. But we always had lots of cats, running in and out and curling up here and there, bringing down half-dead mice from the attic to show off what great hunters they were. And my mother would always stroke them and would compliment them, "Oh, good cat." Everyone, of course, had their own cat curling up in their bed at night. That was kind of the tradition. We just loved it. But never too much, because there was no such thing as going to a vet. If one of the cats started falling over from being too sick or too old, we would wait until we hear a shot from the backyard, the sound of my father's pistol. My brother, Meinhard, and I would then go to the back and dig a grave and then put a little cross on top. My mother had a black cat named Mookie that she constantly claimed was very unique, although none of us could see why. But one day, when I was about 10, I was arguing with my mother about not wanting to do my homework. And Mookie, that black cat, was nearby, curled up on the couch as usual. And I must have said something really uppity, because my mother moved to smack me across my face. I saw it coming and I tried to fend her off, but instead I hit her accidentally with the back of my arm. In a second, Mookie was off the couch. She leaped up between us and started clawing my face. I pulled her off me and yelled, "Ow! What is this? Mom and I looked at each other. She realized that blood was coming down my face, and we both started bursting out laughing. Finally, she had proven that Mookie was actually very special. I would never forget that moment. My brother Meinhard and I were very close. We shared a bedroom until I was 18 and left to join the Austrian army. And I never would have had it any other way. To this day, I'm more comfortable when there's someone to schmooze with until I fall asleep. We were also super competitive, the way brothers often are, always trying to outdo each other and win the favor of our dad, who of course was a competitive athlete himself. He would set up races for us and say, "Now let's see who is really the best." We were bigger than most of the other boys, but since I was a year younger, Meinhard usually would win those head-to-head competitions. I was always on the lookout for ways to gain the advantage. Meinhard's weak spot was fear of the dark. When he was 10, he finished elementary school in our village and graduated to Hauptschule, which was over the ridge in Graz. To get there involved taking public transportation, and the bus stop was about a 20-minute walk from our house. The problem for Meinhard was that the school activities usually ran until well after sunset on the short winter days, so that he had to make his way home after dark. He was too scared to do this alone, so it became my job to go to the bus stop and to pick him up. In fact, I was scared too. I mean, going into the dark alone at the age of 9? Are you kidding me? There was no street lamps, and Tal was pitch black at night. The roads and the path were lined with pine forests like the ones in Grimm's fairy tales, so dense it was dark even in the daytime. Of course, we have been raised on those horrible stories which I would never read to my kids, but which were part of the culture. I mean, there was always some witch or wolf or monster waiting to hurt the child. Now, reaching that bus stop was not a simple matter of following a road. The footpath wound past a castle, an old castle, a castle of ruins, and downhill along the edge of the woods. I remember one night I was walking on the path, keeping a close eye for threats in the trees, when suddenly, out of nowhere, a man was in front of me on the path. I mean, there was just enough moonlight to make out his shape and his two eyes shining. I screamed and I screamed, and I stood totally frozen. It turned out to be just one of the local farm workers heading the other way, but if it had been a goblin, it would have gotten me for sure, that I know. Gradually, our paths diverged. While I will be reading the newspaper's sports page and memorize the athletes' names, Meinhard developed a passion for reading Der Spiegel, the German equivalent of Time magazine. In our family, that was a first. He made it his thing to learn the name and population of every world capital and the name and length of every significant river in the world. He memorized the periodic table and chemical formulas. He was a fanatic about facts and would challenge our father constantly to test what he knew. Now, I had other ideas. Somehow, the thought took shape in my mind that America was where I belonged. Nothing more concrete than that, just America.
The Trigger Effect by James Burke.
At this point, another myth arises. That is the return of the individual to self-sufficiency. But consider the realities of such a proposal. When does he decide that his garden can no longer produce enough to support him? At this stage, does he join, or worse, follow, the millions who have left because of their supplies have run out? Since the alternative is to starve, he has no choice. He decides to leave. Supposing he has the means of transport, is there any fuel available? Does he possess the equipment necessary for survival on the journey? Does he even know what that equipment is? Once the decision to leave has been taken, he is as alone as he has ever been in his life. His survival is, for the first time, in his own hands. On the point of departure, does he know in which direction to go? Few people have more than a hazy notion of the production areas of their own culture. He decides, on the basis of schoolbook knowledge, to head for one of these valleys of plenty. Can he continue to top up his fuel tanks for as long as it takes to get there? As he joins the millions driving or riding or walking down the same roads, does he possess things those other refugees might need? If so, and they decide to relieve him of them, can he protect himself? Assuming that by some miracle he finds himself ahead of the mob, with the country stretching empty and inviting before him, who owns it? How does he decide where to settle? What does a fertile, life-sustaining piece of land even look like? How does he find protection for himself from the wind and the rain? If shelter is to be a farmstead, has it been abandoned? And if not, will the occupier be persuaded to make room for the newcomers, or to leave? If the occupier cannot be so persuaded, will he use force? And if necessary, no.
Okay. Total Recall, Part 2.
Now, it's not unusual for a 10-year-old kid to have grand dreams, but the thought of going to America hit me like a revelation, and I really took that seriously. I would talk about it to everybody. Waiting at the bus stop, I told a girl who was a couple of years older, "I'm going to go to America," and she just looked at me kind of weird and said, "Yes, sure, Arnold." The kids got used to hearing me talk about it and thought that I was kind of weird, but that did not stop me from sharing my plans with everybody. My parents, my teachers, my neighbors, everybody. The Hauptschule, or general school, was not geared to turn out the next world leader or anything like that. It was designed to prepare children for the world of work. Boys and girls were segregated in separate wings of the building, and students got a foundation in math, science, geography, history, religion, and modern language, art, music, and much more. But these were taught at a slower pace than in academic schools, which prepared kids to go on to a university or technological institute. Completing Hauptschule generally meant graduating to a vocational school or an apprenticeship in a trade, or going straight into the workforce. Still, the teachers were very, very dedicated to make us smart and enrich our lives in every way that they could. They would show movies, and they would work with us with textbooks, and they bring in opera singers and expose us to literature and art and on and on. I was so curious about the world that school wasn't much of a problem at all. I learned the lessons, I did the homework, and I stayed right at the middle of the class. Reading and writing took discipline for me. They were more of a chore than they seemed to be for some of my classmates. On the other hand, math came easy. Oh, it was easy for me to do math. I mean, I never forgot a number, and I could do calculations in my head. Now, the discipline at school was no different from that at home. The teachers were hit at least as hard as our parents. A kid was caught taking someone's pen, and the school priest would hit him so hard with the catechism book that his ears were ringing for hours. Or the math teacher hit my friend in the back of the head so hard that his face bounced on the desk and he broke 2 front teeth. It was a tough time all around. Hardship were routine. Dentists didn't use anesthesia, for instance. When you grow up in that kind of harsh environment, you never forget how to withstand physical punishment, even long after the hard times end. When Meinhard got to be around 14 years old and something at home didn't suit him, he would just run away. He would tell me, "I think that I'm leaving again, but don't say anything to anybody." Then he would pack some clothes in his school bag so that no one would catch on, and he would disappear. My mother would go nuts and my father would have to phone all of his buddies in the different gendarmerie stations in search of his son. It was an incredibly effective way, actually, to rebel if your father was a police chief. After a day or two, Meinhard would turn up, usually at some relative's house, or maybe just hiding out at a friend's place that was literally 15 minutes away from our house. I was always amazed that there were no consequences. Maybe my father was just trying to defuse the situation. He had dealt with enough runaways in his police career to know that punishing Meinhard might compound the problem. But I'll bet it took every ounce of self-control. Now, my desire was to leave home in an organized way. Because I was still just a young kid, I decided that the best course for independence was to mind my own business and to make my own money. I would do any kind of work. I was not shy at all about picking up a shovel and digging. During school vacation one summer, I remember a guy from our village got me a job at the glass factory in Graz, where he worked. My task was to shovel a big mound of broken glass into a wheeled container, cut it across the plant, and pour it into a vat for melting back down. At the end of the day, they gave me cash. Wow, did that feel good. The following summer, I heard there might be some work at a sawmill in Graz. I took my school bag and packed a little bread and butter snack to tie me over until I got back home. And then I took the bus to the mill, got up my nerve, walked in, and asked for the owner. They brought me into his office, right along with my satchel, and there was the owner sitting in his chair. "What do you want?" he asked. "I'm looking for a job," I said. "How old are you?" "I'm 14. And he said, "So what do you want to do? You haven't learned anything yet." Still, he took me out into the yard and introduced me to some woman and man at the machine for cutting scrap lumber into kindle. "You're going to work in this area," he said. I started right then and there, and I worked at the yard the rest of the holiday. One of my duties was to shovel great mountains of sawdust into trucks that would then take it away. Now, I remember I earned 1,400 shillings, or the equivalent of $55. That was a good amount in those days. What made it, of course, special, and what made me the proudest, was that even though I was a kid, they paid me a man's wage. Wow. I knew exactly what to do with that money. All my life, I've been wearing hand-me-downs from Meinhard. I'd never had new clothes of my own. I'd just started getting into sports. I was in a school soccer team, and as it happened, that year, the first tracksuits were coming out and were coming into fashion. Black long pants, black sweat jacket with zipper, and so on. I thought the tracksuits looked so wonderful that I'd even try showing my parents pictures in magazines of athletes wearing them. But they would say, "This is a waste." So a tracksuit was the first thing that I bought. And then with the cash that I had left, I bought myself a bicycle. I didn't have enough money for a new one, but there was a man in Tar who assembled bikes from used parts, and I could afford one from him. Nobody else in our house owned a bike. My father had traded his for food after the war and never replaced it. And even though my bike wasn't perfect, having those wheels meant freedom. I always wanted to be an inspiration for people, but I never set out to be a role model in everything. I mean, how could I be when I have so many contradictions and cross currents in my life? Sometimes I prefer to be way out there, shocking people. Rebelliousness is part of what drove me from Austria. I didn't want to be like everyone else. I thought of myself as special and unique, and not like the average Hans in France. No one could put me in a mold. When I was governor, and people would say, "This is what other governors do," or "You can't do that if you're a Republican," or "No one smokes in the capital. It's not politically correct. I would take that as a signal and go the other way. That was always my style.
Alter Ego by Sarah Lara Grywer.
Become a legend. It was a command, but it was also a crazy dream to live by, a stunning credo he issued to himself. It is still, more than 40 years later, the tightest, most thrilling micromanifesto, his term, you could ever read. I want to put an exclamation mark at the end of it, but the original better reflects his own decisions, made long beforehand, that he would become a legend quietly, in disguise and through the back door. His art would be full of secrets and misdirection, mysteries and invisibility, hoaxes and questionable ethics, mischievous games and invented personae, sly humor and deferred surprises set to go off in the future like time bombs. The injunction to view oneself through the eye of history affirms that he has always been in it for the long haul. Conceived according to a logic of delayed reaction, every act in the present has been considered in relation to times to come. Landing in the scene, he found himself in the position of an anthropologist observing a foreign subculture. He learned an essential psychological remove, which allowed him an analytic detachment from his new environment that crystallized and grew exponentially. Radical life art investigations catalyzed his conceptual development. Taking his adolescent contrarian instincts seriously, he followed what he called a protocol of opposites. Whenever he identified a structurally embedded social pattern of behavior among his artist peers, he would do the opposite. He showed a genius for wrong choices and comically perverse moves. In retrospect, it seems that he was working his way toward the exit even as he was emerging. If everyone was determined to build a successful career, he was going to kill his. After 3 short but highly prolific and successful years as a seminal figure of the new conceptual art, he left the scene. He withdrew at the height of his ascension, opting out of all the attention he was increasingly getting in response to his participation in numerous now historic shows. He silently announced his departure, his fade to white. Then he dropped out. He had already moved on beyond the world. Sometimes to become a legend, you have to cultivate obscurity. It helped that dropping out was in the hippie air. Lee Lozano had already tested a temporary withdrawal from the art world in her General Strike piece, 1969, and would soon go further, for longer, in Dropout piece of the early 70s. And then there was Duchamp, his hero, who had publicly quit art for chess nearly a half century earlier in a deceptive retirement that, by 1969, turned out to have been a decoy enabling him to do his work in private. His departure marked a rupture shot through with refusal and a defiance that critiqued the art establishment's self-perceived exceptionalism. In one sense, it was a sharp break with the life and reputation he had built. He dramatically designated the action, "Kill my career." He was punk minus the anger, if such a thing exists. But his withdrawal to the margins was also a specific, premeditated art action integral to the development of his larger artistic project. Disappearing was a contiguous extension, a consistent if extreme escalation of forces already far advanced in his thinking. By dropping out, he was beginning a new, much larger and more radical, life-size art action. He reinvented himself as a regional artist, making conservative work. At the same time, he secretly continued his conceptual practice in private, referring to the entire masked project as his Black Period. Publicly, he chose to work with populist subject matter in a style that would appeal greatly to general audience but make his peers in the contemporary art world gag. It was an irresistible move in the wrong direction, an inside joke he kept to himself. Only in recent years has he broken his decades-long silence on the matter, beginning to speak openly about the covert aspects of his practice to the small handful of inquiring researchers, like myself, who have personally sought him out. This was not the first time he had created a fictional artist persona. He had previously made several life dramas, experimenting with his identity and reputation in an Andy Kaufman-esque manner avant la lettre by temporarily becoming various made-up artists, generally of a comically peripheral provincial type. Framing his actions in terms of a twisted deadpan pursuit of minimalism, he set out to make minimally good work. Always the amateur anthropologist, he brilliantly parsed the opposite registers of the various parallel worlds that coexist within our culture, without intersecting or even acknowledging each other. The escalating scope of these early life dramas called for a drastic expansion in scale and intensification of commitment. In leaving the scene, he actually and sincerely had to become the regional artist he invented for himself, not act out a temporary role as before. He was going for real, lived transformation. Fiction had to congeal into reality, and so it did. Since then, he has become a celebrated regional artist, well known in California. The idea behind this transformation was to carry out a life drama so big and astonishingly expansive over time that it could not be seen in its entirety from any given point. It was huge, operating on a different scale over and beyond everything else, a kind of transcendence. You'd have to step back too far to grasp the work's vastness, which is now so thoroughly enmeshed with the artist's lifestyle, career, and personality as to evade normative perception. He calls what he has done during the Black Period the Elephant Project, so named for its dizzying size and protracted ongoing lifespan, 40 years and counting. He has also described it as minimally minimal, maximalist, or, my favorite, quote-unquote, going for Baroque. The work is so utterly convincing and faithfully carried out, like flawless method acting or a one-to-one scale model, that it is basically imperceptible as art and suggests that being of art may be beside the point. The project acutely risks non-recognition, defying our expectations of what is necessary to make a piece perceptible as a piece. Ultimately, he conceived the Elephant Project as an elaborate strategy to target art historians down the road and give them something to discover and play with. He orchestrated his life as a mystery for us to solve. Concealment and unknowability lie at the core of his oeuvre. Indeed, over the course of the Elephant Project, he has, he tells me, produced a large body of still secret works. In this cultural moment of overexposure and rampant image proliferation, his practice offers the private thrill of invisibility, imagined possibilities, and leaps of faith. Much of his production has gone undocumented into the world, including the underlying conceptual claim of the Elephant Project itself, magnifying the role that unverifiable memory, anecdote, rumor, legend, and oral accounts must play in constructing his history. His art, which resides in the intangible private logic of daydreams and the mental turn-ons of ideas, takes the radical chance of escaping history altogether. He is just as interested in exposing the contingency, misinformation, loss of knowledge, permanent doubt, and infofiction that determines how art history gets written, its mechanisms and limits, as he is intent on being institutionalized within it. The flip side of his transformation into a regional artist has been his emergence as a forgotten or outsider artist and, as of late, a rediscovered one. All in good time and according to plan.
Total Recall, Part 3.
Muhammad Ali and I did a lot of talk shows together. I always admired him because he was a champion. He had a great personality. He was generous and always thoughtful towards others. Once he challenged me to shove him against the wall, if I could. I think that someone in boxing must have told him that he should start lifting weights like George Foreman, because Ali was more known for his speed and his psychology. He was thinking about maybe adding a little strong like a bull to float like a butterfly and sting like a bee. And he wanted to see how powerful a bodybuilder really was. I was able to shove him to the wall and he said, "Wow, this weightlifting stuff really works. Cool, man, this is really cool." The next time I saw him, he had some buddies with him and he said, "Watch this, guys. Hey, Arnold, try to push me again." This must have been a setup, I thought, because nobody wants to be pushed around in front of his friends. I started pushing Ali and backed him up all the way to the wall once again. And he said, I told you guys, you see, I told you guys, this guy here is really strong. This weightlifting stuff really is good. It works. When you walked into the athletic union in Graz, where I lifted weights as a kid, to the left was a long plywood wall covered with chalk marks. That was where we wrote down our training program. We wrote it down each day. Each of us had his own little section on the wall. And before you undressed, you would make a list. I would go to my little space, and I would write down the day I'm going to do deadlift. So I would write down deadlift. Next to it, I would say 5 sets of 6 reps. And then next to that, I would just make then 5 lines that later on I would have to then cross off and turn them into an X. If you look at the script of my address to the United Nations in 2007 on how to fight global warming, here is what you will see. On top of the speech, many lines. They are in groups of 5, just like in a bodybuilding gym. 55 reps. That means the entire speech, which took around 12 minutes, I did that speech 55 times. You have to build the ultimate physical machine, but you also have to build the ultimate mind. Focusing on your body was no problem for me, of course, and later on, after I realized that it is so important to learn, I became really curious to develop my mind. And in my case, America gave me all the opportunities to become rich and famous and achieve my goals, so why not give back to the United States? I always say, we have plenty of time to rest when we're in a grave. Live a risky life and a spicy life. Like Eleanor Roosevelt said, every day do something that scares you. We should all stay hungry.
Who Speaks Reprise by Carl Sagan.
Johannes Kepler wrote, we do not ask for what useful purpose the birds do sing, for song is their pleasure since they were created for singing. Similarly, we ought not ask why the human mind troubles to fathom the secrets of the heavens. The diversity of the phenomena of nature is so great, and the treasures hidden in the heavens so rich, precisely in order that the human mind shall never be lacking in fresh enrichment. It is the birthright of every child to encounter Arnold anew in every culture, in every age. When this happens to us, we experience a deep sense of wonder. The most fortunate among us are guided by teachers who channel this exhilaration. We are born to delight in the world. We are taught to distinguish our preconceptions from the truth. Then, new worlds are discovered as we decipher the mysteries of
Oh boy. Wow.
Yikes.
Golly. Yeah.
Don't you know?
I could definitely detect.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Some internal talking show reference to that. What do you think, Nicholas?
Yeah, there was a good chunk of it that I recognized as perhaps previous episodes of the talking show on K Chung Radio.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh.
I also like the internal consistency, the way the argument built over the course of the whole thing, moving from the different vocal positions one from the other.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting that that iconoclasm came through the sort of like from the Schwarzenegger section, for example, that how could he how he would do whatever he wanted, even if it was the opposite of what was the current sort of political orthodoxy or whatever, smoking in the Capitol, driving a Hummer and being an environmentalist, you know, all that in contradiction to Stephen Kaltenbach, for example.
Yeah, you know, something a lot of our listeners don't know is that since Arnie came on the show and did his bit, Steve and I have started making charts for the talking show that we hang on our bulletin board in the talking show office, which is one of the corner offices in the glistening K-Chung building in Chinatown, overlooking the industrial wasteland of Boyle Heights. And, you know, we'll put things like talk to Solomon, and we'll put a couple lines, and then, you know, as Solomon stops by on the way to his wood shop, Steve will talk to him and he'll cross it off. Maybe, oh, there's the other one I'm looking at, thinking back. God, now that we're here in Toronto, there's, you know, fist bump with Too True, which we do plenty of and cross those down. But then there are some more serious ones like explore phenomenological character of speech and human voice. We've knocked down quite a few X's on that. We got a couple X's knocked down on a really interesting category of attempts to capture ideas from German idealism in everyday contemporary human speech. So you know, it's a crazy effort.
Yeah.
It's like Arnie said, you know, giving a political speech is just like working out.
That's a really good point. That's a good idea. Yeah.
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 Yeah, it really helps keep the thing going, keep it organized.
Well. All right. On that note then.
Yep.
We will just sign off. I'm Steve Cato.
And I'm Nicholas Miller.
And that's been us.
Not them.
Maybe more specific about which us that is. That's Amelia Honing and Jason Hirata.
Oh, I get it.
From Seattle, Washington.
Okay.
All the way from the depths of Toronto, Ontario, to you, our glorious listeners in Los Angeles, California.
Yeah. Thanks for tuning in.
We'll be back at the K-Chung studio next week.
In that corner office.
No more remote broadcasting for us. See you really soon. Goodbye.
Sleep tight.